Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
I'm doing well. It is back to school season, right? Everyone, we are about to start classes here in a couple weeks.
In the Northern Hemisphere,
David. In the Northern Hemisphere, right? It's too complicated for me to figure out what they're doing in the Southern Hemisphere right now. But in the spirit of back to school and people starting new programs and all kinds of things, we thought we would invite to have us join us on this episode two of our, now third-year PhD students, who we thought would be helpful in giving some advice to everyone who's starting a new school year so we can get off on the right footing. So, Kristen and Devin, welcome to the show. Glad
Thanks
to have
for
you here.
Thank you very much.
Should you give their full names?
Well, I was about to do that,
oh, okay,
Frank.
Okay, all right. We're not used to the group dynamic
here.
We'll get there.
Kristen Blackstone.
Hello.
Please introduce yourself to the Whiskey Rebellion world.
So, as David said, my name is Kristen Blackstone. I'm a third-year PhD student. I focus on morale in the Continental Army during the American Revolution, specifically looking at enlisted soldiers. I am originally from Maine, but I have done all of my degrees at Edinburgh, so this is entering my eighth year of living here.
So back to school really means something for you here.
It really does.
You've never really left.
I've never really left Edinburgh, no.
Forever student status.
Absolutely, especially at Edinburgh.
Yeah. Now, Devin Greer, you have not been here quite as long as Kristen, but you have been here...
quite some time. Four years now.
4 years now.
Almost
so,
five.
So introduce yourself to the Whiskey
Rebellion. Am I doing the elevator speech?
If that's how you do.
All right, so I'm Devin Greer. This is my third year at Edinburgh University. And going into my third year of my PhD. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we did your master's degree and then you've had two years here.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's how I met Frank and David and decided to stay on because they were just so lovely and couldn't leave. So I look at the California Gold Rush, but I look at the Scottish immigrants. And looking at the Scottish immigrants is quite interesting because they're quite invisible and they're quite hard to find and they blend in quite well. So it's a challenging project, but what's really great about this project is that these people that blended in so well, they have their own significant roles within society and just things you wouldn't have noticed if you just kind of glance at them. So it's a really great project. So, yeah.
Great. And so for those of you who are listening, those projects will hopefully be done within the next two calendar years or thereabouts.
That's good.
I would hope so.
Yes. Okay, good.
They better be. Listeners, you won't be surprised to learn that when David and I supervise PhD students together.
Which we do a lot.
A lot, yes, and we enjoy it. He's the good cop. I'll let you reach your own conclusions
no, Frank,
about me.
You're the misunderstood cop.
I'm the misunderstood cop.
So we have lots of listeners who are graduate students or people who are undergraduates who are thinking of going into some kind of graduate study. What now as third-year PhD students, what do you wish you had known before you had started? What advice would you give people at the start of a school year about how to begin graduate study?
So I think the most important thing for me, especially for the first year of my PhD that I didn't do that I should have, is find a study space that you work well in and stick to it. I have lots of friends that work really well in coffee shops. I am not one of those people, and I tried really hard to be in my first year, and it left me with lots of unproductive days trying to read things because I was working somewhere that I don't work well. I need an office space to work, and I work well in an office space. But I think, especially going into grad school, one of the first things you should do is look at the different places in the city or even at the university that you have to study and find which one works best for you and stick to it.
Where have you found?
I study at the university. I can't work at my house. I get distracted. I can't work in public. I get distracted. So I come into the university and I work in various study rooms. I like having lots of windows. Don't know why.
Okay.
But I need to study in a room with lots of windows, preferably that has a desktop computer. I like typing more on desktops than I do my laptop.
Okay. Yeah. Devin, where do you work?
I was really smart and brought my dog over. And she has really kind of restricted where I can study. So I study at home, but I work quite well at home.
Okay. But I tend to work a lot at home.
Yeah,
too,
yeah, know? And I'm quite lazy, so it's quite. What does help is when you think of people that work at home, they don't really get ready for the day or just study in their pajamas. I get ready every day, put my clothes on. Well, I don't study in the nude. Put my clothes on, do my makeup and my hair, get dressed as I'm going out, and then I sit down and study, and that really helps.
Okay.
Get me in
the... I study my pajamas, but that's
fine. So what should people... So what's your view about what people should know that you wish you knew when you were starting your PhD? Mm-hmm. People, you would. What's your bit of
so
advice?
So going into my... Well, can I start my graduate studies?
Sure, yeah.
Sure.
Going into my graduate studies when I first came here, I was like, okay, I don't really need to make any friends. Like, I'm quite independent. I'll be fine. But now I know that friends and colleagues and developing relationships mm-hmm. is really, really, really important. So go to those things that you might think that are quite silly, like the little socials before you start the university that the university puts on. If you're extroverted, that's easy enough. If you're introverted like me, listen and seek out the loud people, like I did with Kristen.
Yeah, that's definitely me.
And that's exactly what happened. I went over to Kristen. She said, "Oh, who are you? And what do you do?" And we became instant friends, really. So just give all the work to the extroverts.
We like work. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, she's been such a great help through it all. Editing papers and the amount of monstrosity she's seen on paper before I've submitted it to Frank and David. Mm. Oh my goodness.
First drafts are always awful. Yeah. No matter who you are, yeah. First drafts are always awful.
Just keeping your sanity in check. Make friends. Yeah.
And I think one thing I found, because of course I did my undergrad, master's, and PhD here, is lots of my undergrad friends are still around, but very few of them have done graduate study. And I find the further into graduate study I get, the more they don't quite understand what it is I do and all of the commitments I have to do. And so having friends who are in the exact same situation as you is really helpful just for that common experience, especially third year PhD. I cannot imagine not being friends with other PhD students. That would be awful.
Well, I guess a lot of people come into graduate study thinking it's just going to be just like their undergraduate. Yeah. You're surprised by the extent to which it's not.
Yeah.
It's much more of a job.
Yeah.
You know, undergraduate education, it seems to me, is about the education you receive in the classroom, but it's also about all the other things you're doing. It is about the kind of totality of the experience and social.
And finding well yourself. Really,
yeah, and learning how to live away from home and do laundry. It's all kinds of things. And graduate study is more about the study. Mm. Not that undergraduate study is not, but the focus for graduate school really is what you're here to learn.
Yeah,
and it's entirely independent, so it's not like you have to be in class from 9 to 5. You have to set your own schedule and make sure you get your work done, which for friends who have full-time jobs find that weird because to them your schedule is open when actually it's not. You have lots of work to do.
Which is why Devin's suggestion that you build a network is networking always sounds rather careerist, which it is, and that's another valuable thing we might discuss, but building a network within graduate schools really.
Community,
within your cohort of students. Mm-hmm. Because even, and you guys will know this now that you're third year PhD student trying to finish the dissertation, you're actually in quite a different position than those first year PhD students who feel like they have all the time in the world and don't really know what they're working on yet.
But I miss that period.
Well, I mean, and the other thing you may find going forward is not only are the cohort of people you're in graduate school with useful to finishing the PhD, but it's also really useful after the PhD because those end up being people you're on conferences with and people you help, you know, network with. And obviously that's a loaded term, as Frank pointed out. But I talk to people I was in graduate school with all the time about various, you know, work and other related things. And you never know when somebody who may have been in a different field from you may cross paths and might be useful to maintain those kinds of friendships.
I mean, we're using back to school as our kind of organizing concept here. And of course, if you're on social media, you see that, you know, lots of pictures of kids going back to school.
Mm. And some professors this year.
Right, yes. Yeah, I'm going into 25th grade or whatever. but
Frank, you're going into much more 25th grade.
David.
He makes fun of me for being young. I can make fun of him for being old.
But graduate school, so if going to school really as a child begins either in kindergarten or first grade, primary school, The first time that really changes in a different way, it seems to me, qualitatively, is graduate school. Mm. Because all the other levels are kind of like, that's the next grade. Mm. So you go from primary school to secondary school or junior high, depending on the education system, to university. That's kind of all on a continuum. Mm. Graduate school is different because a lot of people have exited at this point. Mm-hmm. And so it's a new phase, and there are relatively few people, and I'm looking at the two of you. Mm. You understand what you're doing mm-hmm. and have gone through together. But as you say, Kristen, it's difficult to explain it even to your friends who you went to college with mm-hmm. just a few years ago.
So, you know, if you don't have this sort of structure that other school levels have, how do you structure your time? Other than badly. I mean, that was autobiographical.
I really wish there were video here. Expressions.
I try, you know, when you come into graduate school, the first thing that someone in graduate school will tell you is treat it like a 9-to-5 job. Which is really good advice, but I don't like waking up early, so I treat it like a 10:30/11:30 to 7:30 job. Mm. And
well, if you do your 40 hours, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's exactly. A flex time job.
Exactly. Exactly. So just as long as you see it as a full-time job, I think that'll help you organize your time and develop a regimen, develop a schedule.
In master's, it was slightly easier because we still had classes to attend. Mm. And so you come in for the classes, you stay in all day and work, and vice versa. For PhD, first semester I didn't do this, but for the rest of the semesters I've done the same, except I'm teaching the classes. Mm. So I always, as much as possible, schedule my classes for first thing in the morning, one, because I like teaching in the morning, and as Frank also does, and did when I was an undergrad too. And it gets me at the university before 10 o'clock, but it also means I'm done teaching by 10 o'clock. I can do little admin things relating to teaching after that. And then I have the rest of the day to sit where I already know I work well and work on my PhD. And that's helpful. Yeah. Hmm. And lists. I really love lists.
Yeah.
Lists.
I love writing lists.
Yeah.
And I have lots of them for different things. I think even if it's something tiny that I know I need to do that I've been putting off, just having lists and being able to check off lists, especially on days where I feel really unproductive, is very helpful.
Let me ask you this, and this may seem stupid. How do you keep your list? Do you do them on your phone, or do you actually have physical lists?
I have physical lists. It's something about being able... I keep very little on my phone. I still have like a diary where I write in all my appointments by hand. I take most of my notes by hand. But lists, it's something very satisfying about being able to cross something out or check something off in hand that isn't the same as deleting it on my phone.
And I strongly suggest getting a diary or what do they call it in America now? I'm forgetting my lingo.
Planner?
A planner. Just to get all your dates down. Mm-hmm. I started doing this thing last year. I've started kind of bullet journaling. It's where you kind of just plan your day with check boxes and little symbols to tell you what's important. And it's really helped me stay on track and see what kind of day I'm about to have or what week I'm about to have. There's tons of videos on YouTube. And you can kind of stylize it like you want it. So
both of you are more organized and scheduled than I am, so I'm impressed by
it. I mean, you say that, but my lists include, like, get coffee, have cake, as something small and accomplishable.
Victory,
that
we'll all But I've accomplished two things today.
Yeah, see, something as benign as pick up the library book, which I have, which I had today. I checked that off. I felt great. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I do have...
write a chapter.
I didn't check that off yet. See, well, check that off
yet. Eat cake, write chapter. Okay, good.
I do have daily and monthly lists. So I have a monthly list of bigger things I need to accomplish, like write a chapter or, you know, write the bibliography for this chapter. Mm. And then smaller daily tasks that I know I can do. That way I'm always working towards what I need to do for the month without putting all of that pressure on one day.
Now, how much... Think about the research. How much did you know what you wanted to do when you came to graduate school, and how much of that did you figure out when you got here after you started?
I knew my subject, as in the people. I knew the people. I didn't much know my place. I knew the broad area. I was initially doing Scots on the American frontier, which is huge. But with the help of my lovely supervisors that are sitting before me today. I narrowed my projects and To Scotts in California during the Gold Rush, and found a happy niche there.
How hard was that to do, to go from sort of this inchoate idea to a... Because I find for lots of students, that's the hardest part, is figuring out exactly what their handle is on.
It was, but as you come to narrow your focus, you become quite more and more relaxed about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have more purpose. So it's, as you're narrowing down, it becomes easier. I think that was the biggest worry of this whole PhD journey so far, is what exactly am I looking at?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think one of the things, especially doing going straight from master's to PhD in the UK, is you end up applying for your PhD with the project you have in mind during your master's. So before I had even thought about my master's dissertation, I had to come up with this idea for my PhD. And so coming into PhD, I hadn't thought about it since my application, and I needed to kind of refocus and refigure out what I had intended. Mm. And then, as Devin said, figure out how that actually is going to work and narrow it. So I came in with the project Morale in the Continental Army, and I'm still doing that, but I'm doing it in a very different way and using different sources than I think I imagined when I was a master's student. And I think that's good. Like, that's part of the PhD process.
Yeah.
And it had my thing not changed at all between my master's first conception of it and now. That would be a big problem.
I mean, the reason why I asked that is one of my most strongest memories from graduate school is on the first day, a professor coming in and saying, right, we're going to go around the room. I want you to tell me your name, where you went to undergrad, and what your research project was.
Mm.
And being halfway across the room, because I knew my name, I knew I went to undergraduate, but I didn't have any idea what my research project was. And I'm very glad they didn't start with me, because I was able to make something up by the time they got there. And everyone else was deeply confident about what their research project was. And what I didn't realize on the first day was that they were all lying. And only, I think, one of the people actually ended up staying on that particular research project. And some people, you know, drifted a little bit, and some people drifted to whole different fields by the time they finished, if they finished. But I didn't know they were lying when I was on the first day and everyone was trying to impress everybody else.
Well, but also one of the big differences between a British PhD and an American PhD or a North American PhD is that here students come in and they start the dissertation theoretically on day one.
That's true.
Whereas in the U.S. context, students will be doing, you would have been doing several years of
coursework
before you started your dissertation.
And comps and all those
Kinds of you had time to figure it out. Whereas these women had to know, had to have some idea of what they were going to do.
Sure.
All projects evolve, but...
Yeah, no, okay, to be sure, there's a different kind of structure to the PhD. Yeah. But
so, in fact, that we might have wanted to say that at the outset.
Yeah.
By third year PhD students, that means you guys are in the home stretch.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
they nod their heads, yes, we're in the home stretch. Okay, that's good.
I'd like to point out, we just became third year PhD students today. Like,
yes.
We both passed our second year reviews today. It's a new thing.
So one of the things you guys are doing in addition to all this research is, both of you are tutors. Translation for Americans, that teaching assistant.
Mm-hmm.
We have different names for all these things. I have no reason why. How do you balance teaching and doing the research? Or let me rephrase that. Do you balance teaching and doing the research, and how do you do it?
This will be my fourth semester teaching, and I have gotten better at balancing the teaching and the research, but it is something that you need to work on. Especially first year, I know I definitely did it, and having spoken with other PhD students, they've done the same. First year, the first time you're teaching, you have that impulse to read absolutely everything. You have to know everything, and you prepare everything because you've never taught before. You're worried that some undergrad is going to ask a question that you can't answer and you can't get out of, and you're going to be embarrassed. And that takes up a lot of your time, and you put a lot of effort into taking notes and preparing, which is very good, but it means you over-prepare and spend more of your time teaching than you do on your research, which is not beneficial at the end of the day. The more I teach, the more I realize that I actually have a base knowledge that is more than these undergrads, and that reading very specific articles and understanding those articles is going to help aid fostering discussion, which is really my job in the class. I'm not there to sit and lecture them on these things that they need to know. I'm there to make sure that they can discuss these ideas with one another and I'm just there to lead that.
Yeah, I didn't teach the first year, and I'm glad I didn't, because I needed time to settle in my PhD. I struggled my first semester teaching and doing my research. But I was at a point in my PhD where I kind of could take a break.
New stuff.
She says,
I passed my review, so I'm fine. I did a lot of secondary reading for my research while I was teaching. So I try to involve myself in my project. I know going into teaching this year, I'm going to do a lot better time management wise, just because I'm more comfortable teaching. I kind of know what's going on. I know what to expect. And like Kristen said, you don't have to know everything. I think that best advice that I got for teaching is just be a day ahead of your students. That's all you need to do. They have no idea. You don't know. I remember we were teaching reconstruction the day before. I was like, David, what? I went to David's office. I'm like, David, can you just remind me what reconstruction was? Because I just don't remember anything. And it was fine. I was fine.
I could have gone to the lecture where I did. Anyway,
I was doing research.
That's good too. But on a practical level, how do you go about? Do you sort of say, okay, this is a research day, this is a teaching day? Is that? Because I know some people do that. Some of our colleagues do that, where they say, "I'm doing."
When I started getting into the flow of things, I did the day before is teaching. I focus on getting ready for teaching, and then the day of teaching, I taught half the day, and then the rest of the day, I did the attendance and comments on their performance. So 2 days for me when I first started. I'm hoping to just do one this year. We'll see how that goes, but
it really depends on my teaching schedule. So there are some years where I'm teaching all of my classes in one day, which is great because I can prepare for it the day before. I can teach, do classroom attendance, make notes on people's participation, and that's me done with a day and a half. This year, I'm teaching on 3 separate days. So I have no intention of having 3 teaching days and 2 research days, because that would be a terrible plan in my 3rd year of my PhD. So I think it's actually going to end up being segments. So if I teach for an hour, then I've got like a 2-hour segment to reread over my notes and make comments on what the students do in class. But luckily they're all the same segment, so it's not like I need to have full preparation for each of the days, if that makes sense.
Okay. I find it very hard. I mean, I don't know how much work you get done during the teaching semester, Frank. I have a hard time sometimes getting research and writing done in the midst of everything else.
I agree. It's very tough, in part because teaching is a form of performance. And so it's quite tiring. I mean, because you have an adrenaline rush when you do it. But then after you've done it, it's like eating lots of sugar, you know, and then you're kind of shattered afterwards, or you can be if you're teaching a lot. So during the teaching semester, I mean, our teaching semesters are relatively short, but they're pretty intense.
Yeah, we don't need breaks for Thanksgiving or other kinds of things.
So it is difficult, although I try to reserve a day or two, but it's often difficult to really do it. Although there's nothing like a deadline to concentrate on.
To be sure.
You two both have deadlines to work with, so that does help. But I agree with you, David. And the older I get, we've already established I'm the old person. You know, it's paradoxical. I mean, it's a kind of paradox, I think, as you're more experienced. You don't have to do as much preparation. Everybody makes the same mistake starting out. When you're a graduate student and you're doing your first teaching, as Kristen said.
And it may not be a mistake the first time you do it.
Well, that's true. Right. Fair point. But you over-prepare.
Yeah.
And even when you're newly minted in your first teaching job, you over-prepare. I don't over-prepare now, but you still prepare. You have to prepare. Preparing is really, as you get more experience, it's not about reading this or that, although that's part of it. It's as much as thinking about strategies for how you're going to teach this or that, and what worked last year, what didn't work, and things like that. So there's a degree of mental preparation that's involved that's really important. I really like it. I mean, that's one thing. I really enjoy teaching, but it does take it out of you.
And can I just add, I'm actually remembering some actual research I did during teaching. If you have research that takes a lot of time but not a lot of brain cells, do that research then. Like, during that period, I was just looking at newspapers, and all I had to do was search a term, and then the search engine would give me all these newspapers, and I saved them to a file, and that was that. And I had them to read later.
Yeah, there's different kinds of intensity.
That's a very good point, Devin. There's a lot of sort of administration mm-hmm. around research that mm-hmm. you can mm-hmm. do, that you can do between classes or on days when you're teaching.
I've got to write an index during the first 2 weeks of teaching, and yeah. I can, yeah.
Right, as opposed to the concentrated thinking that's required to write a chapter.
Yeah.
Yes. Which is very difficult to do mm-hmm. while you're teaching, but you can. There's a lot of support we have mm-hmm. to provide for ourselves and our research mm-hmm. in order to write,
yeah.
and those things can be done while you're teaching.
And I think knowing the flow of the teaching schedule is also important. So for us, we have 2 weeks to mark essays and get them back to mm-hmm. students. And if you're teaching three classes, that's 36 essays you have to mark, plus maybe a few more. In 2 weeks, and marking essays actually is quite a strain on your brain and on your eyes and sometimes your sanity. And so knowing that those 2 weeks of the semester, you're probably not going to get a lot of intense research done or writing done, and planning around that helps too.
That's right. Now, how do you think being a PhD graduate student is different now than, say, 10 years ago when I was a PhD student, or 20 or 25 or however long Frank was PhD? No.
If you could see the looks in the room right now.
What are some ways in which graduate study...
I hate
study...
you all.
this is a serious question, Frank.
Yeah, okay,
what's the way in which what way is your experience different fundamentally? What do you need to know and do that's different from the way that when we were in graduate school?
I think one way is the availability now that PhD students have to senior scholars via social media. Twitter Storians is this huge thing, and there are some of the best scholars working on any subject in history that will be on Twitter, and they post on Twitter a lot, and they're very good at interacting with the public in general, but also with scholars. And so that means if you interact with them on Twitter and then you meet them at a conference, it's not this person who you know by name and book only. It's someone you have maybe interacted with or just seen and are much more comfortable speaking to them in person. And I think that helps bridge the divide PhD students can sometimes feel between professionals in the field and them as aspiring professionals in the field.
Yeah, I'm going to go on the tangent of information. I think now with technology, we have a lot more information available to us, a lot more sources. There's data mining, there's big data. We can search newspapers by a term in like half of a second that historians of old, like Frank, I'm kidding, that have, like, the people have had to go through microfilm for hours and days, and I'm so thankful for that. And yeah, it was quite funny because I was reading this article from like the 60s, and he was doing British coverage of the gold rush, and the information that he had access to is completely different to the information I had access to, and because of that he was just blatantly wrong with the information that I had, because I had so much more, and he was just looking at, I wouldn't say he's blatantly wrong.
Yeah,
wrong,
push
but he was
back
just,
on that a
yeah,
little bit.
I wouldn't say he's blatantly wrong, but he was just looking at the surface.
He had access to less stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the difference, I mean, I do think we've lost something, and this is the old guy speaking, but in other words, you're absolutely right. The things we can do with digital resources are amazing.
Mm.
And the things, you know, you're both writing on American topics here in Edinburgh, and in part that's possible because of digitized sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I use them all the time.
As do
I. They're amazing. The one thing we've lost, or a thing we've lost, though, and I remember this from graduate school before resources were digitized. And you're absolutely right, Devin. I remember writing some of my first research papers in graduate school and spending hours and hours and hours in the basement reading microfilm and microfiche. The advantage of reading microfilm newspapers, and I might have said this on the pod before, is your immersion in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I would look all day and I might not find anything in the newspapers relating to what I was writing about. But all that time I spent reading New England newspapers from the 1760s and 70s gave me a kind of feel for the texture of life that you don't get when you data mine, when you just put your search term in and you get your hits.
Yeah.
So believe me, I love data mining. I love the ease with which we can find things. But there was a benefit to the old way just because it was born of necessity. It wasn't as though we chose to do this. So that guy, you're talking about, who wrote an article 50 years ago, he probably read a lot of California newspapers, and he probably knew a lot. So I would push back a little by saying it was superficial. What he probably didn't have was a thick evidence base because he was finding it all by hand, as it were, by eye.
Yeah.
What about you, David? What do you think?
I think both of those are, I mean, I think the way we do the way that they're able to do some kinds of research is very different than the way that we had do. But I think the social media thing really is important, because there's a way in which I think you have to brand yourself now while you're a graduate student that we didn't.
It wasn't possible.
Well,
and we didn't
know. We
wouldn't have dreamt of it.
Well, I mean, if you... No, I mean, we did try to brand ourselves. We went to conferences. We gave papers.
Yeah.
And, we might write an article or a book review while we're in graduate school. But, even then, sort of getting yourself known through those mechanisms was very hard. Whereas I can think, I see lots of graduate students on Twitter, many of whom have far more followers than lots of senior scholars because they're very good at doing Twitter. Now, whether that means they're also good scholars or not, I have yet to see how that plans out over the next decade. But at least they're people who have legitimacy online as a consequence of their ability to do social media.
I mean, Kristen, you're active in social media, and kind of professionally as mm-hmm. we're creating a brand. So I think you've been pretty successful in that. So that's the positive interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
The negative would be, and I'm going to caricature you.
Go for it.
So why are you wasting your time on Twitter? You should be writing your dissertation.
Yes. But then it takes 25, 30 seconds to write a tweet. And I send it off and then that's it done.
But how much time do you spend on Twitter?
Not that often.
Right, okay.
I could be significantly more active than I am.
Are you on Twitter, Devin?
I am. But I was going to say another negativity of Twitter is when you're impulsive like me, and then you tweet something you shouldn't really share with the rest of the world.
Mm.
You shouldn't. So I kind of try to stay away, unless I know it's like kosher and PG.
Mm.
But that's just me.
This proves we're doing it live. Yeah.
Well,
so
I also tweet about my research a lot, which I think has been useful because lots of other people who are interested or who are doing similar topics in a different way have gotten in touch because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tweet too much about my personal life, although I have more recently, especially when I'm traveling. Funny things always happen when I'm traveling.
Have you ever tweeted out like a research question, hey, Twitter historians, can you help me with this?
Yeah. I have transcribing letters or diaries.
Hmm.
Sometimes the handwriting, there's a word that I just can't get. And there's so many people on Twitter who are excellent at stuff like that I can put it up. And within 20 minutes, people will have come up with either the same word and they all agree, or they will have come up with different options that I can then put into context. So that has actually been extremely helpful. Broader research questions, not so much. But the specific things like that I have.
For somebody coming into graduate school, how do you then sort of start building that kind of Twitter presence or public persona? How do you do that?
I would say, go back to my first tip, was make friends.
Mm-hmm.
And make friends with people already established on Twitter. Make friends with people in their second, third year PhD, because they'll have been established. They'll start retweeting you once you get your mm-hmm. presence on Twitter. And they'll have really good tips about what to say and what to post. And
yeah, start with the networks in person. And then also people who you like to follow or you admire, or scholars you like their work of, et cetera, et cetera, and go from there.
And what's the hashtag for, like, if you have a little question, is it hashtag Twitter historians? See if you know any of those answers. And
I mean, it's interesting because what I've seen is some historians, and both graduate students and more senior scholars, are really, really active on Twitter and use it in quite innovative and interesting
mm-hmm.
ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know a number of scholars who would never go on Twitter
mm-hmm.
and are very productive and eminent scholars as well, and successful graduate students. It's interesting to me that some people have really kind of embraced it as a platform and used it in interesting ways, and others just wouldn't dream of it.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think today, and this is, I guess, has been true for a very long time, is that the job market is very competitive, and distinguishing yourself from everybody else who is writing excellent doctoral work is difficult, and any leg up you can get can help.
But I think because of that, Devin's admonition at the beginning to be
careful
what you tweet as a graduate student is really important.
Yes, I would
agree.
It's
true for everybody, but it's especially...
Yes.
Yeah. Like, be careful with politics and religion and Yeah. Yes.
That's why research is often a safe bet.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So this may be obvious to everyone who's listening to this, but both of you are Americans who are studying American history in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that and the sort of various, you know, what's good and bad about studying American history from a distance. Because I know we have lots of listeners who are graduate students who are studying American history, some of whom are Americans who are studying in America, some of whom are Americans who are studying here. What's good and bad?
Some of whom are non-Americans studying in the United States.
So we have all the permutations available that I didn't think of. Yes. So
you must be more cosmopolitan than you know your mind. You neglected the Southern Hemisphere.
My limitations are apparent every week on the show. Anyway,
I think I've always had itchy feet, and I knew I wanted to do history. I'm still in the stage of life where I really don't know what I want to do. I'm just gonna stay in school and study what I like studying. So I was like, okay, is it really a thing to do American history, but not in America? Cause I really don't want to live in America anymore. Yeah. So I think just in my searches, Edinburgh University came up. I've been there before, visited Edinburgh before, loved it. And then on the American, history, page for the graduate studies, it just said something like, we're the best. This is the best place to study American history outside of America. And then
we say that? Okay.
Yeah, you do.
Good.
It worked on me. It worked on me.
Okay.
The faculty looked great. Just kind of came here on a whim. Got a student loan. I didn't have the money to do this. But I am so happy with my decision. I really enjoyed my master's. It was really difficult. I feel like it was a lot more challenging than my undergraduate experience, completely different. But enjoyed the experience so much, like I said before, that I ended up staying here. So that's how an American came to Edinburgh.
I moved here when I was 18 to study Scottish history, I would like to point out. I did not come to Scotland to study American history. That was not my original intention. Halfway through my undergrad, decided that actually I didn't find Scottish history as interesting as I thought I was going to, and I much preferred studying American history. And so I did. By the time it came to applying for grad school, I loved living in Edinburgh and Scotland so much that I really didn't want to leave. I considered applying for PhDs in America and decided not to because I like living in Scotland so much. And I think another reason is one of the benefits of studying American history outside of America is that the American history community is much smaller, but that means for a grad student, it's much more accessible. So you do not have the entire American continent and most American universities, which will have American history departments with copious amounts of grad students, et cetera, et cetera. In the UK, it's a much smaller pool, but it means I know a lot of the American history community, definitely in Scotland and probably even in the UK in general, at least by name, if not in person. And that has been really good as a grad student to feel part of a bigger community, even if that bigger community is quite small.
So I just wanted to add that learning American history outside of America is really enlightening. And I think it's your job as a historian to look at history from all different aspects that you can, and kind of learning the history of where I was raised and just learning it from the outside looking in is a really great and illuminating aspect that I wouldn't have been able to learn back at home. And I knew that kind of coming in here. I want to know what these Scottish people think of our history. But then come to find out you're both.
Because Americans come and take our take Frank and I teach a class together.
I want to get a British perspective. Don't take our class.
Because we teach it more or less the same way that we would teach it in an American university.
I think so. Yeah.
Except you teach them how to pronounce Maryland.
Yes. Well, yeah.
But it's an extremely important thing to teach British students. They all get it wrong.
Yeah. Well, if that's the one thing they get wrong, then they're doing okay.
But then I've pointed this out before with both of you, like, I'm not going to say where I came from, but
she's in the witness protection program.
I grew up in the South, and they teach things a little bit differently there. And just coming with a fresh perspective, learning with a fresh perspective of my history, which is tough, I guess, and I don't really know what to say about my the history of the South.
Where are you going? Where are you going with this, Devin?
It depends on who teaches the history in the South and what you learn.
That's true everywhere.
It is. But it was just made very apparent to me.
As C. Van Woodward says, there's the burden of Southern history.
Yes, that's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
So what's challenging, if you guys have very glowing versions of what's like to study America from here, what's the hard part?
Sources, I think. Accessing the sources.
Yes.
Yeah, the internet only takes you so far.
Yeah, it's very true. A lot of the sources, especially for my PhD that I work with, haven't been published. Or if they are published, they were published in the 19th century, and so sometimes getting them is difficult. I've been privileged enough to receive research fellowships to the United States that paid for me to come and research at different institutions, and that has been wonderful. My project would not be the way it is right now if I didn't have those opportunities to go and research. Sources is a huge issue. There's also the distance issue. If something happens with family or if you need to get back for some reason, America is significantly further away. Having said that, I've lived in Scotland for 8 years now, and I very much consider Scotland my home. So most of the other issues with adapting to living in a foreign country and creating a community for yourself, I haven't had to deal with as a grad student. I did as an undergrad, but the grad student transition was much easier because of that had already happened. For new grad students, I would imagine that would be quite a difficult. And actually, I saw it in my master's year at Edinburgh. We get lots of Americans that come over, and Canadians, actually North Americans in general, that come over for master's because it's a one-year program and it's a really good opportunity for them to decide whether further graduate study is where they want to go, and it gives them a chance to live abroad. And I know for a lot of the Americans that came in my master's year and in other master's year, they really struggled with the transition and finding a community. Mm.
I think that's true. Going to graduate school anywhere, it's hard to fit in. All right, I think we're at the point where we do last drops. Ladies, why don't you guys go first? What would you like to endorse?
Okay. I'm going to be the nerd here and endorse a video game coming up.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I have a lot of, quite a few really close friends that work at Rockstar down the road here. And, ironically, they're making a game in the middle of Scotland about the American frontier. It's called Red Dead Redemption 2. It's their second, well, actually third installment of the series. And just with my friendships with these guys, I know that they're very, very invested in making sure these games are historically accurate. So for those of you who like staying in the future, sorry, not the future, staying in the past, spending your past time not living in the future, this game is going to be amazing.
But Devin,
yeah.
They're striving for historical accuracy. Great. How can they call a game about the American frontier Red Dead?
All right. You know what? I didn't even know about this. I thought it was the Red Dead about the blood that you get from being dead. But you know what?
I think it's reference
to blood.
I
learned something new every day.
Well, it might be a reference to blood, but
I
heard you and I thought, gee, that's kind of racist.
Yes.
I know. But anyways, it takes place in 1899, like...
It doesn't make it any better.
Well, it's the fall of the frontier with the rise of industrialization. You're a gang member, and you get caught up in a bad bank robbery, and you've got the feds just chasing you across the heartlands of America. So some of it's set in the South.
Well, and the first game I thought was actually... I mean, it's total fiction, but it's also total fiction that seems like it's rooted in the sort of Western... film in some ways mythology as much as the Western history mythology.
David's a gamer.
Yeah. Much more so than Frank, who only plays FIFA.
FIFA's the only game to play.
That's another episode we're going to have. Okay, so we're all looking for, okay, so Red Dead Redemption.
October
Red Dead
28th.
When's it coming
October
out?
October
28th.
October 28th,
okay.
Hopefully.
Okay, well, we'll have to have a episode about the game when that comes out. Excellent. Rockstar, by the way, I think their other big series they're famous for, of course...
Grand Theft Auto,
which these two series, which are fundamentally about like America and like American culture, that are made here.
No, they're about a certain version of American culture as imagined by demented Brits.
but like mostly they're like through movies. You know, the Red Dead. These are westerns versus the Miami Vice gangster movies, whatever that are. So it's an interesting sort of version of where those come from. They're all guys.
And I just should mention that David's like. He's just gotten so excited talking about video games. He's just like a complete change of personality.
I love video games. Like video games, like comic books. I'm a nerd. The listeners know this. This is fine. Kristen, what do you got?
My last drop is completely different. So as I said earlier, I was lucky enough to be in the U.S. doing research this summer in Virginia, primarily near Washington, D.C. And I was lucky enough to get a ticket to go to the new Smithsonian. I say new, it's probably about a year old now. The National Museum for African American History and Culture. And I had heard rave reviews about it before I went, and I never doubted them, but they did not do the museum justice. If you are ever in the DC area and you have time to only do one thing, this is the one thing you should go do. It's a really well thought out museum. To go to the history section, you have to go down an elevator that only fits about 40 people. And so you're staggered as to how many people you're actually in, you start the museum with. And the elevator is the only way to get down to that history section there. And then it's a ramp that gradually inclines as you go through it. And it starts in Africa and the history of the slave populations that were brought from Africa to America in their home country and then moved, home countries, and then moved. And as you go through the museum, because you're constantly going up very slightly inclined ramps, no matter where you are in the museum, you can always look back at the history that's there and see exactly where you started. And so it's this really well thought out story of continual change and growth and progress and setbacks and heartbreaks. It's incredibly well done. I went at 10 a.m. right when they opened, and we didn't leave until 4 o'clock, and I could have been for another 12 hours very happily. The restaurant in the museum is also one of the best I have ever been to. They have a really, really great food court.
Oh my goodness.
What do they serve in the
So they've split the food court up into different sections of historically African-American food, and so they have like Southern comfort food, and they have Creole food, etc. They've got a barbecue station. Huh. It's great, and you get a tray, and you can go to all the stations, you can go to one of the stations, and the food is phenomenal. Huh. I was really impressed.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
So cool. The museum is great, and the food.
I've heard
great.
Good things about the museum. This is the first I've heard about the cafe. Okay, good.
What do you have, David?
I want to actually endorse something that I think you endorsed about a year ago, but I'm going to endorse a different version of it. So I think I may have mentioned this in our last episode. I've been not doing so well health-wise the past few weeks. I had some eye problems and other kinds of things. It was generally awful. I won't describe that because it would horrify people. But it involved me lying in a darkened room for days at a time. And to occupy myself, I was listening to some audiobooks courtesy of the Edinburgh Public Library. And one of the books I listened to was Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, which I think, Frank, you endorsed on the show, but I list the audiobook, which is read by Bruce himself, and I thought I wanted to sort of highly recommend people either read or listen to Bruce's autobiography. I only had two comment critiques about it. One is there's no music on it, unfortunately, so there's a point where he's talking about the river. It would have been really great if they had put 20 seconds of the river on there. And the other comment of it is Bruce, I think, as most people know, is an extraordinary storyteller in concert. Usually like half of his concerts are him telling stories and not actually singing songs, which is why they're all 4 hours. He's not as charismatic when he's speaking in a recording studio by himself. I think he's better when he's got an audience and a band behind him.
I think anybody who's ever tried to record something, though, it's pretty. If you've ever sat in a studio by yourself,
it's sterile. So it's not quite the same experience, probably. But it's, I think it adds something to hear it in his voice. So I want to recommend the audio version of Born to Run. Frank, what you got?
I actually have a sad last drop, David, which is I want to acknowledge the passing of a really great historian and great person. So a few days ago, Jan Lewis, who was a great early American historian and the dean at Rutgers in Newark, Rutgers University, Newark, in New Jersey, passed away after a brief illness. I knew Jan pretty well and got to know her
really in the past few years. I mean, she's a great historian. Her first book was about family in Virginia during the early national, revolutionary and early national period. She wrote widely in, she wrote a very good article, an important article that appeared in the William & Mary Quarterly called The Republican Wife, which was a bit, kind of followed on from Linda Kerber's work about Republican motherhood. Jan was a really important scholar, but I don't want to talk about her scholarship. I want to acknowledge just what a wonderful person she was. She had a great sense of humor. She was very, very friendly. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at two young women scholars across the table from me. Jan was so supportive of scholars, young and old and male and female, and she was a real mentor and just a really, really good person with a really good heart, and she will be missed by everyone who knew her.
So, on that note, till next time, Frank.
Yep, bye, David. Okay. Thanks.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.